This is a Boardroom Network production.
Because as we said, it's messy.
Yeah, it is, but I suppose it's messy because, as I think we've agreed, the world's messy. But in order for any business to succeed, it needs people that actually crave organization and order and process, because that's how you get predictability and that's how you get success. So you do need, you need both kinds of people, and you probably need less of the crazy ideas being thrown into the pot than you often do with that. Well, how exactly are we going to do this?
Yeah.
How are we going to pay for it? Who's going to do it? What are the deliverables? All of that stuff that probably entrepreneurs like me find dull, absolutely necessary. In fact, they are.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, so Head Up Labs was something that sort of was conceived in my mind over the last few years, and it's sort of a response to a few things. One is that, as I touched on, our population is incredibly unhealthy.
Welcome to the Boardroom Podcast.
Thanks, Jaden. Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Awesome to have you here. And probably a really good point to start, and where we like to start with most of our guests, is what's been your journey like up until this point? Where did you grow up? What did you do? What was that first job like? And how did you get to doing what you do now?
I grew up in Melbourne. Hated school.
Uh-huh.
Went to uni. Thought that'd be a lot better. Was about the same, so hated that as well. Dropped out of uni. Bought a round-the-world airline ticket. Figured I'd just... Can you swear in this?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I put my life in a backpack and just kicked the shit out of it for about a year. Around the world, but actually started in Asia. And I think as a kid who's sort of, 19, getting off a flight and suddenly immersing yourself in a completely different world, it was almost like visiting another planet, it felt like. And, to cut a long story short, probably the big lesson I got traveling around the world by myself at such a young age was how easy we actually have it in Australia. And I remember thinking, sort of consciously and subconsciously, when I get back to Australia, I'm going to work hard. Because if you work hard in Australia, you're almost guaranteed to succeed. Whereas, even for people that travel now, you go to third world countries and it doesn't matter how hard people work, they can never rise above poverty.
Well, there'd be a very, very small percentage that would.
Maybe
they're not, well, it is hard work, but maybe it's some talent they have, whether it be an athletic capability or maybe not necessarily in the business world. It's some of these, and we see in these third world countries a lot of the time, it's the really good athletes that are from some of the poorest villages or communities that are actually the nation strong points and what the local people look up to. So, as you said, it's very hard from a business perspective as well to get out of that cycle almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just looked at people and thought, if I was doing what you were doing in Australia, I'd do pretty well, but you're really struggling just to put food on the table.
Yeah.
This was a long time ago. I'm pretty old, I'm 47, but in fact, a lot of the world has now, dragged itself out of poverty, but there's still a lot of it. But anyway, for a young person...
Yeah.
I suppose the lesson is you don't have to sit in a classroom to get taught. You don't have to go to uni necessarily. That's not everyone's journey.
Yeah, for sure. So how did you take those initial steps once you came back from travel? I assume you came back to Melbourne. What did you do when you came back?
Yeah, I came back here, and obviously without a degree, I figured I needed a skill. So I was sort of doing hospitality work and stuff like that, but I was given a job, funnily enough, by an ex-Collingwood player, a bloke called Craig Stewart. And his partner, Mark Freeman, and they taught me how to sell. So yeah. I saw selling as, a lot of people see it as a dirty word, but I saw it as a skill that was really valuable. And in fact, when I look at my life now, it's one of the most valuable skills you can have. Mm-hmm. So I learned to sell there, and then I got a job with Puma, and then I got a job. I was really interested in sports. So I worked there and then got a job with Sportsco. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of AFL footballers involved in my journey. And then I opened my own business. I had this goal to open my own business by 30, and I think knowing I had that goal in the back of my head, yeah. I paid really close attention to the people I worked for. And you'd learn good things, and also you'd learn from their mistakes or where they were coming up short. Mm-hmm. But I had good sort of mentors on the way up.
Yeah. Do you think that was really important to start in that initial business?
I reckon it was. Yep. Not for everyone necessarily, but no. Do you know what? I often think with starting a business, like we've all got friends that say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and they don't. Yeah. But I don't think there's anything wrong with not doing it. But I think for those of us that end up starting a business, I actually liken it almost to you hit a point where it's almost like your head's being held underwater. You know, if your head's held underwater, and then eventually you come out above the surface and you just gasp for breath, mm-hmm. that sort of visceral desperation. It's the same with starting a business. I think for a lot of people, it just gets to the point where it doesn't matter. I have to start this. Even if I think the odds are against me and it's probably going to fail,
yeah.
I can't not do it. I can't go to my grave not testing this. Yeah. And that for me was kind of that point.
Yeah. That's quite an interesting analogy, hey?
I don't think I've ever heard someone say it in that manner because it is probably that difficult. You probably do have to look at it from that perspective in terms of, well, yeah, this is going to be real challenging. And unless I'm super desperate to do it and go through it, you're probably better off not doing it. It's probably what you're trying to get at there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, yeah, because you kind of are forced. I think for most people, when you start a business, you've got to borrow money, you've got to take risks. You leave behind a job, a salary, maybe mm-hmm. some superannuation. Mm-hmm. You leave behind a title. You leave behind an identity.
Yep.
You're kind of burning the lifeboats. Like,
yeah.
This is where I am, and I'm going to make a go of it. So you do. And I think mm-hmm. if you start with that sort of that mindset, then sure as night follows day, you're going to get hit with stuff that's going to knock you over. And you're going to have times where you're going to wake up and be in the fetal position and think, I just want to pull the doona over my head again. I can't face this. Like,
yeah.
You know, I'm behind it with my taxes, or I've got salaries to pay and I just don't have the money in the bank, or
yeah.
I've got a container arriving from overseas and I can't pay to get it through customs. Like,
yeah.
You know, this whole thing could collapse.
Yeah.
And you're often confronted with that when you're running a business, and somehow you just got to get out of bed, put one foot in front of the other, and just get on with it. And I think if you kind of start with that mindset of, it doesn't matter, I've just got to do this, then you tend to just keep getting up and...
Yeah. Do you think you had... Like, were you subconscious to that pressure in terms of... Like, were you aware of the pressure and what you had to do around it and take certain steps? Or did you just, like, intuitively take the steps against the pressure that was, like, didn't have the money to pay the salaries, things were happening, things may have... gone one way and then end up going another way. Do you think you acted on that intuitively, or you were kind of present around, oh, I've got to go do this and I now got to go do that?
It's a bit of both, and it sort of varies, but I think the other thing is you often find yourself where you get away with it. Like, things suddenly fall into place. Like, someone pays you, which allows you to make sure you can pay other people, or somehow...
It works out.
You can't somehow figure it out, and what that often tends to do is... give you this sort of sense of bravado of, something will come over the hill and it'll be all right.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, your best employee resigns, but you know what? Somehow
someone else is gonna come
a better one came in the door a month later, or I lost my biggest client, but geez, I've gotten a call and all of a sudden I've got a better client. So somehow something keeps coming over the hill.
You've got to be just quick on your feet. It's got to be...
Yeah, I guess.
Do you know, a bit of it's that? Like, that actually sounds...
adaptable and flexible.
Yeah.
Whatever situation or event or circumstance comes up, then it might not always be positive. As you said.
I can think of a million people that would simply crumble under that pressure, or not really know that, you know what, hey, it's happened in the past and something just happened. It might happen again in this scenario because it is such a high pressure situation. It's like, is that even possible? Like, I know it happened once before, but to have that optimism that there's a potential... opportunity coming from this bad position. Do you think you always had that?
I think everyone's journey or everyone's hardwired a bit differently, whether they've started and succeeded with business or not. But I think probably the one common gene everyone has that's in that position is that they just don't feel sorry for themselves for very long. Like, you know, you might get home and feel sorry for yourself, but somehow when the sun comes up the next day, dusted yourself off and off you go. And I think that's the thing. If you're the sort of person that's going to give up, then you're probably not going to make it, because sure as hell, stuff's going to hit you that's...
It's really the understanding of, you know, mistakes and things that aren't going to go well, the ability to really channel your energy in the other direction and go, right, I'm going to accept that some things aren't going to go right, but in my quest to, you know, start something up, whether it be a business or, you know, in whatever you're doing, you just got to keep putting the next foot in front of the other. It doesn't mean that you don't reflect and you don't take time to stop and go, all right, how can I maybe, you know, avoid some of these mistakes in the future? But, you know, there's always going to be stuff that is unavoidable at the end of the day. Like, you know, we start a business, you know, and you want to start a business and you don't set out to do anything wrong. You don't set out to... you want it to be successful and make $1 billion or so.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you know, life's... We see all the issues and, you know, life is... That's what life is. It's not... just positive. It's a whole mix of, you know, everything. It's a whole mix of everything, and you know, everything is everything. Everything's got the great things. Everything's got the good, the bad, the ugly. You know, it's got everything. So you need to be able to. That goes for business. Nothing's going to be 100% perfect.
I so don't think you go into it expecting that as well. Like, if I reckon, if you went into business expecting that it's going to be all rosy and things are going to go the way that you set out in this eight-point plan or whatever it might be, and it's just like, all right, this is going to happen and that's going to happen, then you're kind of delusional to the reality of what business is then.
Yeah, I understand that, but what I'm saying is a lot of people don't want to, like, it's if you have that mindset, that's good, because you've accepted that, you know, that is the real reality, but I'm still thinking that I reckon for a lot of younger people, they're still going to be very rosy about, you know, what they can achieve, and that's really good, and you want that, but you need to also keep grounded in your thoughts and understand it's going to be a hard slog and it's going to be a hard road. There's no easy fix to things, especially business, and getting from 0 to 100, there's only a few of those ideas in the world that have done that, and you know, they've also had their troubles as well, I'm sure, some of those big companies. So, and we've seen that, especially with social media and all that sort of stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, it's never going to be too rosy.
I think that's true, and it's probably true of anything that succeeds. Is from the outside, on the surface, it looks great, but this is true of everything, I reckon. Behind it, it's a mess. And that's, to an extent, that's okay. I mean, obviously... some things you can't compromise on, like safety and those sorts of things. But there are other things that you are just figuring it out as you go. And, you know, I think it's funny, like as a footy supporter, you watch your team run out and they look magnificent and you just assume that that's how it looks. But actually behind the scenes, it's kind of stuck together often with just bits of wire and tape, you know, like because you're dealing with injuries and people going through emotional stuff, and it's... sponsors that might not renew, and like there's stuff going on in the background you can't see, and it's ugly, but you know, I guess the face you put to the world's a bit different. And I think probably for people that start a business, often if you're bright, you've got good grades, everything's buttoned down, you start a business and think you can create a business and sort of control it, and it'll be quite, you know, I've got a business plan and I'll hit budget and I'll borrow this much money and everything will work and I'll hire this person then. And the reality is it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Do you think it's because it's people? Like, as people, we're not super linear in what we do and how we go about it, and business is such about people. Do you think that's the reason why, or do you think that's just the nature of what it is?
I think, as Tom just said, it's life. Like, it's messy.
Yeah.
And if you don't like mess and you don't like just constantly having problems to solve, then, you know, as much as I said, you know, the optimistic entrepreneur expects something good to come over the hill. You know, something else is coming over the hill that's pretty bad. I mean, I think I've always had this theory that every business on the planet is 3 phone calls away from being wiped out. You know, it could be some catastrophe's happened, your staff are leaving, your clients are leaving, the bank's decided to foreclose, something horrible can happen, and you could kind of deal with one, you could deal with two, but three at once, no.
Yeah, it's tough.
I think it's the ability for whether it be owners or CEOs to really take on the mess and who can endure it for the longest and still, you know, get stuff done while that's happening. Maybe that's a sign of the best businesses.
Yeah.
Who really tackles the mess head on, doesn't shy away from it, and then can endure it until there's a bit of a better time, and then once they go back down and dump, they endure it really well. They're conditioned, they're hardened.
Yeah,
it's like there's parallels.
Well, that's but well, it's a lot like footy. Yeah, it is.
Funny how you say that, Joe.
Yeah,
because I'm sure you'd say, Glenn, that it's you know, there are similarities and why a lot of sports people, if they do go into business and they're, you know, got some sort of intellectual ability and you know what they're doing, they do go well in business because they're competitive. They know how to interact and work in a team, a lot of especially team sports as well.
Really important.
They're the ones that, you know, seem to do really well. Mm. But going on from that, let's talk a little bit about Virgin Pulse and your journey once you partnered with Virgin and that sort of story and what I alluded to with Richard Branson before and that sort of stuff. Talk to us a little bit about the pathway of how that all transpired.
Yeah, so I had a business that was an ad agency with a business partner, a bloke called Johnny Hillier, who's a really talented creative director. And the two of us started this small ad agency, creative agency, and it was pretty successful pretty quickly. It grew really quickly. We attracted lots of lucrative clients, and we did well. But just as we were starting, I had one of Australia's greatest ever athletes, and actually he's a national living treasure, Herb Elliott, in my office. And this was not too long after the Sydney 2000 Olympics. And I remember saying to him, it's amazing how good Australians are at sport. You know, we just punch above our weight on the sporting stage. And his answer was not what I thought he was going to say. He said, we do, but that's just a very small cohort of our population. Our general population doesn't move, doesn't exercise, isn't athletic, is doing the wrong things in terms of their lives, and we're on the wrong track. In fact, we're probably only one generation away from being able to field a globally competitive workforce because of our state of health. And then he looked at me and said, well, you're creative. Why don't you figure out a way to fix it? And so from there, I kind of looked around at what was being done, and having, I guess, the advantage of having an ad agency, we were used to kind of solving problems. And so we conceived this idea for what became the Global Corporate Challenge, which was take this, you know, a wearable. So back then it was a pedometer, similar to a Fitbit or an Apple Watch now, that counted how much you moved. Most people suddenly were connected to a computer. Google Earth was a new thing. And so we conceived this idea where people were encouraged to take 10,000 steps a day by wearing a pedometer and then punching in what they did, and then it would move them along this virtual race course around the world. So it was a very novel, interesting, innovative, tech-fueled idea. And I remember going back to Herb Elliott and saying, I reckon I've got the idea that will get people to move. And he said, that is a good idea. And I said, can you introduce me to some people at the government? He's a pretty powerful guy. He could get the PM on the phone if he wanted to. So he lined up some meetings in Canberra. So I took, you know, storyboards, and he even helped me with the introductions. And we went around to different departments in Canberra and said, you know, this is about getting a whole population healthy. This is the future. And I remember us flying out of Canberra and me turning to him and saying, well, Herb, that went shit. And he said, it did. And I said, why was that? And he said, well, now that you think about it, the government doesn't really care about whether you're healthy or not. They don't really care. And I said, well, who does? And he said, I'll tell you who cares, your boss. So why don't I line up some meetings with, at that time, it was Graham John, the head of Australia Post, John McFarlane, the head of ANZ, the head of Telstra at the time, and exactly the same pitch, but the response was completely different from CEOs, which was, I've got a population, I need them to be healthy because I need them to show up and work hard and perform and be creative and sell stuff and build stuff. So they got behind it. And so pretty much to cut a long story short, in that first year, we built the website, shipped the pedometers, created this event, and it just took off. And over the next 12 years, it grew by about, my aim was to double it every year, make it twice as good and twice as big. I didn't quite achieve that goal, but again, to cut a long story short, it was acquired by Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Group a couple of years ago now. It's a successful Australian idea that took on the world and ended up being rolled out into 185 countries and then exiting to Sir Richard Branson. So it's a good story.
It's a pretty wicked story. Mm. Like, even just the opportunity to go to the government and be like, oh, here's this incredible idea for the population. And then seeing that perspective, was that really eye-opening to know kind of how they look at things?
Yeah, it was a bit. But, you know, I guess employers tend to look at people as a human resource, whereas if you're the government, what are people? They're always causing problems. So you've got to build prisons and hospitals, and they're just a pain. Life would be easier without people, whereas to a business, people are everything.
Yeah.
So logically, that's where it fitted.
Yeah, and worked.
I'm bamboozled by that.
What do you mean?
Just that whole government politics and how they... Yeah. I mean, you're sort of right, though, how that's how they view...
Yeah. Well, I guess that's what they're looking at every day, all day. Yeah. And that's how they look at the problems that they've got to solve.
Is I think...
They're causing more problems. Maybe. And our job is to solve them, but we can only solve so many.
Yeah.
There's always just more and more problems. How on earth are we going to do this? And I think that probably opens up a really interesting discussion around perspective, I think. Like, we see certain issues from our perspective and to whatever extent that is. And then we're expecting them to see it from our perspective, but their perspective is just so, not blinded, but in such a high-end macro level that how could they ever empathise or see the perspective of people in these situations? So I've always been fascinated by how big of the distinct between the people solving the problem and the ones that actually have to face it day-to-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute. I wonder if there is a disconnect between the two and how can these type of people influence the solution, but knowing that there's 1,000, millions bloody problems out there.
What I find weird is that if the government, when you present it to them, if they said, yeah, we do love this idea, I wonder how much that would have, decreased the amount of time and effort they'd have to put into hospitals.
Of course it would,
These other things, mental health, you know, or like fitness and getting people moving would actually be a catalyst towards a better population that will see less people getting unhealthy in hospitals, psychological issues.
Well, and everything that leads from that, I guess.
Physical and mental issues. Yeah. And then, as you said, everything that carries on from, not being in the shape that you want to be as an individual, as a human, and then, you know, what can lead from that. So it's like it's a whole... If you went back and did that now, it's sort of like, that's why I find it bizarre and a bit weird how these are all sort of things that they're implementing once the problems have already occurred. But it's not like, all right, take a few steps back and unpack it. Go to the raw issue here. How can you prevent having to put something in place down the track, saving you millions and billions of dollars?
Yeah.
Why don't you actually try and implement a strategy to do with, say, fitness and movement in place so we don't get years down the track and then the government are having to just build more facilities for these sick people that unfortunately are in the state that they are, and there would have to be a percentage of it that is to do with health, weight, you know, how much sedentary time they have in their day, and they're not, nutrition, all that sort of stuff. That would play a part. That would be a percentage. So it's just bamboozling how... seriously.
It is. A couple of things that have emerged just in the last few weeks that talk to your point. One is... In Denmark, they've just shut a bunch of hospitals. And the reason they've shut a bunch of hospitals is a few years ago, they decided that it was going to be a hell of a lot cheaper to decentralize, for want of a better term, healthcare and work on prevention. So let's put our money in making sure people don't get sick so that they don't cost as much. So we'll invest in that so we don't have to build big, expensive hospitals. Mm. Better outcome for everyone, and it's worked, and they're shutting hospitals.
Yeah.
Compare that to here, where they've just announced an election. And if you listen, you keep hearing talk about, we're going to build a hospital here, we're going to build a hospital there. It's, to an extent, maybe it's a bit of pork barreling, but that's sort of what people want to hear. You know, if you're a politician announcing the building of a new hospital and then going and cutting a ribbon for the new hospitals, makes you pretty popular.
Yeah, but makes you look good.
But longer term, it's a race to the bottom, really. So those two things.
And that's, as you said, it makes you look good. So it's all just for getting votes.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's probably a very interesting conversation.
It is.
I don't want to get too political because it's not really what it's about to you, Glenn. But, the elections around the corner, why not?
Well, I think, too, to your point, a lot of hospital admissions are avoidable. I mean, most of the numbers you look at are that around about half of the people that will show up at a hospital today wouldn't be there had they moved, eaten better, and not smoked. So those three things, move, eat better, not smoke, you halve your chances of ending up in a hospital. Or working on, say, a population health strategy, just focus on those things and you won't need as many hospitals. And I suppose the other thing, too, is the hospital beds are then there for people that,
really
that have just been unlucky and really need them.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. That said, I think it's really also important not to victim blame people who are out of shape, because often there are a myriad reasons for it, and it's very complex.
Yeah, I agree.
But more needs to be done to help people stay healthy so that they don't enter. You know, we call it the healthcare system. It's kind of a dumb name. It should be called the sick care system, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
We kind of don't have a healthcare system.
No, that's an interesting perspective.
Well, there's a gap. There could be a gap in that.
Yeah, well, it just depends on where you're looking. Are you looking at it as a thing that's happening right now, or you're looking at it as, if we do this, what is a byproduct in the long term of something like... Do you actually think that mentality of looking at it now for the prevention of the long term is actually a really good strategy when it comes to business as well?
As in a business?
Or a business in terms of looking at a problem now or having a preventative solution idea to a problem now for the long term, instead of looking at something to solve right now for this type of moment?
If you're talking about healthcare, I mean, probably the one place to look is the US, which has a very convoluted, ugly, inefficient healthcare system that costs twice as much to run as just about any other system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place where people literally lose their house when they get cancer. Like, it's that onerous on people to get sick. The problem with that system is it is just geared to deal with people once they're sick, and there's almost no incentive to make them better.
Yeah, right.
Or stop them getting sick in the first place. Yeah. And so, you know, at least here in Australia, we have a really good socialised healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least we got that.
Yeah, for sure. Let's probably move it towards some of the business side of things and work. Where do you see... So a conversation that we had pretty recent was around... how automation coming into the workforce is potentially going to have some form of impact, whether positive or negative, on employment opportunities. Tom and I are kind of that position where we think it will just open up different opportunities in a different area, and we'll just deploy people in a different set of skills towards different problems. What is your viewpoint on terms of technology, automation, and then the shift in kind of the workforce?
I've got a business now, Head Up Labs, and it's funny. When I looked around today and looked at the people working there, and there's only about 20 people. It's an early stage startup venture, but not one of those jobs existed 10 years ago. So they're all completely new jobs that if you gave the job description to someone in the year 2000, they'd go, "That I don't know what that is." Mm-hmm. So it is amazing how quickly things move. And there's no question that in another 10 years, there'll be a whole bunch of jobs that don't exist today. I know that's almost becoming a cliche to say that, but it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way I think we can stay ahead of the curve is to make sure that we do innovate and that we encourage entrepreneurship and we encourage students to study science and technology and engineering and maths. Mm-hmm. As a country, we've probably, and I'm getting political here, we've probably spent too much time patting ourselves on the back for digging stuff out of the ground and exporting it, which is good, but, you know, there's a whole much bigger opportunity there to add value to those things and, mm-hmm. and use our brains the way some countries have, like Singapore and Israel and yep. to an extent the US.
Yeah,
I mean, they've
definitely.
Just been amazing at innovating it, yeah. Almost creating their way into wealth.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to say that because we've talked a bit about, I guess, the secondary school systems and the tertiary, you know, education, university, and that sort of stuff. And you said yourself that you weren't a big fan of school, you weren't a big fan of university. Can you touch on, you know, what your general feelings were, you know, when you were going through that? Well, why was there a particular reason why you didn't quite connect with potentially that sort of system and where you were better placed in the business entrepreneurial sort of scene a little bit later in life?
You know, there's a type of laziness I think I have that probably a lot of entrepreneurs have, and this laziness is the laziness that kind of goes, what's the point in, if getting a C will get me through, then I'll just get a C. What's the point in getting an A? There's nothing extra really. I'm still going to get, graduate, I'll just get C's and spend my time doing other stuff.
Just like 50%, I'll just get a pass.
Yeah, correct.
Well, you only need 50% and you get the degree. Same with the person who gets an A, they get the degree as well.
Honestly, I think at school, subconsciously, it was like, if I get a C, I won't even get a D, which is a bare pass, so I'm not even on the radar of anyone. I just sail through with C's. Whereas I think the A and B students were sort of more driven, they were probably better at retaining information. They were probably better at comprehending information. They were probably better at passing exams. And I wasn't particularly good at those things, so I think I just wasn't hardwired to be a good student. And I think the other thing is, when I look back now, it's an odd system where you kind of just sit there and you just got to listen.
Yeah.
Some of us just aren't good at sitting still or listening.
No.
Just not. But it doesn't mean we're dumb or we're not good at other things. And so I think when I came out of school, probably subconsciously, I thought, those A and B students, it sounds bad, but those A and B students, I'll employ them one day.
For sure. It's actually probably an extension of the conversation in the last episode that we had with Dan around, we go through this system of schooling from what we're 5 to and high school, and potentially if you go onto university as well. That's around you as an individual, your score, everything you do kind of impacts you, it doesn't really impact many others, and you can kind of get a C or 50% and pass and go through. But then from my perspective, at least, when you go into the workforce, it's like, well, actually, my results and my input and what I do as a result of my actions are going to affect the person next to me because we're all moving towards the similar goal. So if I don't hit what I want to do, then it's going to affect Tom that sits next to me and his job is this. It's like, well, if I don't get my stuff done, then Tom might not be able to get his stuff done. But we've just gone through a system where it's all about me and it doesn't really have much to do. Obviously, there's group assignments and that, but That's a bit of an outline.
There's a whole bunch
of conversations around that. But we go through a system where that's what we do, and all of a sudden it completely flips, and then employers are like, well, what do you mean? I got 50%, but it's fine. It would be all right. It's like, well, if I went to my boss and I'd be like, I did 50% of the job that you asked me to do, pretty sure he'd rip my head off and I wouldn't have a job. So to think that that's kind of acceptable for this system that we go through for so long, and then it's all about us and my output as a result doesn't really affect many other people, but in a job environment it does. I find that to be fascinating.
No, I do too. I mean, there's probably the fact you got to sit still and listen, which is hard for kids. That's odd. The other thing that's always I've thought odd about school is, why do they compartmentalize everything? Like, this is geography, and now this is PE, and now this is maths, and nothing crosses over. It's not like a teacher says, what you just learnt in biology, here's how it relates to you now in phys ed, and here's how, you know, the trajectory of that kick relates to what you're about to amass. No one can do that because it's different. It's all siloed, and yet the day you leave school, it's like, oh, geez, the world's all mixed up together. Mm. It's all mashed up.
And so
you're kind of already thinking in the wrong way.
Yeah, 100%. I just think, like, we go through a system where you're thinking one way, you go into the workforce, and depending on the culture and whoever's leading it, thinks in a different way. And then they're like, well, why are you thinking this way? It's like, well, I don't really know any other way to think because that's how I've been thinking for the last 12 to 16 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I've got to go through this transition of switching my mindset, which is kind of where I believe that whole conversation around, well, younger people kind of don't like sitting in the same spot for too long, or they don't know. So it's like, well, they're just kind of uncomfortable in this environment. They put pressures on from other people who are expecting a certain aspect from them, but they're just not aware that that's what they're expecting.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, this is an environment I'm not really comfortable with. I'm going to bugger off and go to another place and see if they allow it to me. So then it starts this conversation like, oh, they're not loyal. They're really picky. They just want this. They want that. I'm like, well, I think this just a... I think the mindset of employers is one, and that as a culture is one. And then people who have just gone through 12, 16 years of this education system is thinking this one way. And then you've got these few years of clash where it just is a bit of a mess. And people are thinking one way, they're thinking the other, but they make the decisions. But then ultimately you can just go bugger off and go try somewhere else. So
yeah,
I think it opens up, obviously, a very big can of worms with all that. But
yeah,
I guess that's my
It's a bit what you touched on there, Glenn, how they compartmentalize. Does it come from somewhere higher up? That, you know, the whole education system and linking that with the workforce once you leave school, with, you know, getting as many people to try and, you know, sort out what they want to do, you know, pigeonhole them almost, and then go, right, that's because it's easy for the brain to, you know, put people into slots and people into, it's harder to probably connect so many different things, and that's where it takes a more sophisticated mind. But do you think it's from a workplace point of view in the wider world, it's easier to try and get more people into, you know, certain different jobs that they can do, you know, whether it be the one job, and then it's sort of, it's just an easier sort of, I guess,
way to
access
it.
And path. Yeah, it's a management thing rather than, if you have every single individual in the world trying to start a business, trying to be an entrepreneur, and it's a little bit, you know, it's everything's all over the place. It's it's like, well, try and get people into a trade as quick as we can, or, you know, something that they can do.
Yeah.
They're 9 to 5 and they're happy with that, and they'll keep doing that, and that's, you know, they're accounted for. You know, we've sorted that out. But if there's so many people trying to come up, have those different mindsets as you've talked about, and are a bit rebellious in that sort of one-dimensional way of thinking, if there's too many people like that, well, then it might be a bit of a
wacky system.
Bit of a head case for the government and the people up.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, you're absolutely right. I mean, not everyone can be an entrepreneur.
No.
Nor should they. And in fact, as an entrepreneur...
It's not even entrepreneur. It's just someone that's got an idea that wants to try and, you know, make it a thing. Because entrepreneur, that word, as we've said, it doesn't need to be sugar-coated or, you know, put up in lights. Because I think too many people say, oh, I'm an entrepreneur, and it's, well, they think it's some sort of a status thing, but we're not, you know, we're saying right now, we're not condoning that it's a status thing. It's just someone that's got an idea that wants to
take the financial risk.
Because as we've said, it's messy.
Yeah, it is, but I suppose it's messy because, as I think we've agreed, the world's messy, but in order for any business to succeed, it needs people that actually crave organization and order and process, because that's how you get predictability and that's how you get success. So so you need both kinds of people, and you probably need less of the crazy ideas being thrown into the pot than you often do with that. Well, how exactly are we going to do this?
Yeah.
How are we going to pay for it? Who's going to do it? What are the deliverables? All of that stuff that... probably entrepreneurs like me find dull, absolutely necessary. In fact, they are.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, so HeadUp Labs was something that sort of was conceived in my mind over the last few years, and it's sort of a response to a few things. One is that, as I touched on, our population is incredibly unhealthy, and that's a combination of a bunch of things. We're seeing now a rise in wearable technology. So there are things you can wear. In fact, we carry our phone around just about everywhere these days. Plus the things you can wear that can capture data about you. So I think that's an incredible opportunity. The rise now in big data, where data can be not only collected and stored, but analyzed, offers pretty fantastic potential. And so when you think about those three things, I kind of look at it and say, well, there's an opportunity now to make people healthy both physically and mentally by using wearable technology and using big data. And that's what HeadUp is. It's effectively, you know, what I would term the human dashboard. So this is a way for a human to actually understand themselves. So what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? Physiologically, psychologically, where am I? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you kind of think of most complex machinery, whether it's a car or a plane or anything, there's a dashboard that tells you what's going on, and lights will come on if there are problems.
Yeah.
And it's got gauges and all kinds of stuff. And yet there's nothing in the universe that we know of that's more complex than a human. Our mind, our body, it's incredibly complex, and yet we just fly blind. We've got no dashboard. Mm. And if something goes wrong, rather than a red light coming on, often we find ourselves in hospitals.
Mm.
Or cemeteries.
Yeah.
And so, to my mind, there's a way to now fix this and give people a way to understand their state of health and monitor it ongoing in real time all the time, by harnessing what big data can do and data analytics and wearable technology. And I think the beneficiary of this is individuals, but it's also society more broadly, because as you mentioned, Tom, there's an opportunity to keep people out of the healthcare system if we can catch things early.
Mm.
It's a way for people to capture their data and then use it themselves. You know, if you want a cheaper insurance deal, then, well, here's my data. I'm a much lower risk than anyone else.
Yeah, true.
There are just so many ways that this can be a really powerful idea.
Yeah.
And so now I guess I'm in the fortunate position that I have the capital and the time and the access to talent and all of those kinds of things and the experience to be able to assemble it and put it together. So that's what I'm busy doing.
What would you say to young professionals and young people wanting to come work, you know, in your startup at the moment? What would some of the skills be, or, you know, what would you like to see?
I try to treat a business like a professional sports team, which is aiming pretty high, but see, no one should be allowed in that's not nice and humble. Like, that is just that sort of no asshole rule that people talk about, or Paul Ruse's no dickheads rule up at Sydney, is one I abide by. They've got to be smart, and they've got to be curious, and I think that last one's probably not something people list that often, but as we said, the world's messy. Technology is propelling itself and us at such a fantastic speed that you can't just show up and keep doing today what you were doing tomorrow and expect to still get the same result.
Yep.
So people need to be curious.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it. That's what we look for. We don't necessarily look for a particular kind of degree. We certainly don't look for a kind of particular school or anything like that. And probably the other thing is we look hard for diversity. So we try to employ as many females as we can. We try to employ as many people as we can from minority groups.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I'm a great guy, but I am. But but because actually that makes you better. Like, those 100%. Viewpoints are so valuable and help you understand the world. And and I suppose that's the last thing is as an Australian tech company, this isn't our market. This is the market we start, but our horizon is the world. Australia is a small market. It's, you know, what, less than 1% of global GDP, tiny percentage of the world's population.
Yep.
In order to really make it big, you want to shoot for the whole world. And we're lucky in Australia. We've got people from all over the place. So,
yeah, for sure.
So get them in early and learn from them.
Yeah, I love it. Fascinating conversation, Glenn. Thank you so much for spending the time to chat to us and kind of go a little bit on topic, but really appreciate you spending the time.
Thank you for listening to the Boardroom Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and stay connected with us via our socials. For all the latest news, updates, and episode insights, head over to our website, theboardroompodcast.co.